It's 19 hours 30 UTC on Monday, January 1st, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
When you've been to South Africa and back, you start looking at yourself, start looking at your environment, and you start looking at your dreams.
That was a young Zimbabwean talking about his hopes for 2018. We'll have more New Year expectations from Zimbabwe coming up. Good evening. I'm Ayan Bior.
And I'm Chidonjere on a special taped edition of VOA Zimbabwe Today.
After 37 years, Zimbabweans have only the second president since the end of white colonial rule. Emmerson Mnangagwa replaced his former boss and the leader of the Liberation Party, ZANU-PF, Robert Mugabe. Zimbabweans around the world have raced to keep up with the rapid changes in the country. VOA's Zimbabwe service, which broadcasts in both Debele and Shona, has been there from the start. Here with us in the studio is Demyake Mwakalyelye, the head of our Zimbabwe service. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Demyake, this was one of the biggest, if not the biggest story out of Zimbabwe in decades. How did VOA's Zimbabwe service respond to the news of former President Mugabe stepping down?
Well, as soon as we got over the shock, it was one of those events that you just could not have seen coming. The difference between what happened in the morning and what happened in the evening was really revolutionary, I guess people would call it. So basically what happened is we got the news about the tanks coming in and essentially the military taking over the state media around 9 p.m. By 11 o'clock p.m., we were on the air and basically reporting on the hour, by the hour through the rest of the day. So that first week was really tumultuous because we started off with the announcement that the military had taken over the state broadcaster and essentially had the president at the time, Robert Mugabe, and his wife under house arrest. And everything was so uncertain for a long time. So we were really tested in terms of our journalistic ability to really kick into that gear that needed to be kicked into at that point to really cover the story as it was unfolding. And for a long time, there was really not much we had to go on because a lot of things were going on behind the scenes. And we were trying to get information, trying to get what people... A lot of people did not know. A lot of people did not know. They had to wait and get the information from us when we started broadcasting. Luckily, as I was saying, literally on the hour, every hour from about 11 p.m. right through to 12 o'clock the next day.
So what were some of the challenges you and your team faced when it came to reporting some of these stories? Were people forthcoming with information?
Well, that's the thing. Of course, the team rose to the challenge. They rose to the challenge. You know, as journalists, you're always ever ready, but the only difficult thing is you never know when or how that news is going to break. We've been waiting on the Zimbabwean story since 2003 when we started. So basically, of course, 14 years later, there was an expectation that something would have happened. Either, you know, the question was how it was going to happen, whether President Mugabe was going to leave the office forcefully, either through incapacitation or through resignation, as what eventually ended up happening. So basically what we ended up having to do, the challenges that we had was, of course, trying to fill in those hours. And like I said, everybody just rose to the occasion and we were able to do that. What was a challenge, I guess, was being able to get the information as it was happening, because a lot of the things, a lot of the developments were still really behind closed doors. You know, the army was in control at the time. Unless we had access to the army, it was a question of speculation. What are people saying? What are people thinking? What are the indications that this and that is happening? So it was really interesting to try and build stories around that. But then, of course, because I work with such veterans in this field, a lot of people are connected and they have people on the inside. So you knew what was going on essentially with Mnangagwa, who was at the time in South Africa. You knew essentially what was going on with President Mugabe, who was at the State House, from people just kind of sharing. But of course, most of it we could not go on the record with because it was not, you know, substantiated news or from an authoritative source. But, you know, we were able to piece things together. And then we were on air a lot. We got a lot of feedback and a lot of comments from our listeners and our audience, because we were also live on Facebook and we were live on the radio. So we were able to get a lot of people to just call in and just share their messages.
How did this change your reporters, stringers on the ground, and other journalists in the service? Was there any fear of violence in the country?
Well, it was such a heightened, it was a heightened time, you know. Yes, we're obviously very concerned for the well-being of our reporters. We have a lot of reporters on the ground, and it was a question of, you know, which way was the army going to respond? You know, over the years, there's been a lot of harassment of the media, and there's been a lot of, you know, suppression sometimes also of the voices of the media. So it was a question of, well, what can they do that is safe, and what can they do that at the end of the day is not going to get anybody too, you know, too noticed and in trouble? To our interest and our surprise, actually, our reporters were able to basically penetrate the system and do a lot of coverage from the ground. We had one problem, which was the technology, or I should say the Wi-Fi or the network. There were a lot of times when we needed to get our reporters on the phone, including the day when there was the inauguration of the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. Couldn't get a line, couldn't call in or out. So that kind of compromised us a little bit. But then, of course, you know, because we were on air for such an extended period of time, we were able to pick up at some point.
Well, thank you so much, Numiake, for joining us in studio today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
COVID-19 has been eventful for Zimbabweans. They survived a cash crisis, an unemployment crisis, and a political crisis that saw the dramatic exit of Robert Mugabe after 37 years as president. So what's next? Reporter Kuzai Shinivashi speaks to some Zimbabweans in Harare to get an idea of their hopes for 2018. For most, the answer is simple: a better economy.
Kuda Kwashe Jena is a graduate who recently returned home to Zimbabwe.
I'm 25. I graduated this year, and I'm looking forward to having jobs, to a better economy. You know, I've been to South Africa, and when you've been to South Africa and back, you start looking at yourself, start looking at your environment, and you start looking at your dreams, and you realize going back to South Africa is better. But at the same time, you want to be at home.
Darlington Tsozo is a shop owner in Harare Central Business District.
If you can have enough money in terms of cash, because the problem we are facing right now is we are making orders that require cash instead of using EcoCash and swipe. But when we are selling our product here, people have EcoCash, they have money in the cards. So if you have enough cash in 2018, I think it will be much better for us.
EcoCash is Zimbabwe's biggest mobile money service. It and bank cards sometimes fill the vacuum caused by the continued cash shortages. Langton Moyo is a young Zimbabwean. He says he is optimistic about the coming year.
Since we have the new government, obviously we are looking for a positive change in terms of all sectors of the economy, politically and socially. We are looking for change whereby, you know, we get more opportunities as young people.
For vendors, their year was a never-ending cat-and-mouse game with the authorities who want them off the streets and confined to specific locations. Vendors lost their wares and had to pay fines if they were caught. The vendors' associations argue the government is not involving them as it makes decisions about vendor locations. Clive Murambiwa is a vendor in Harare.
They should consider us because we are putting some percentage in the government structure. Harassment of vendors should be addressed, and they should put one of our members in the government so that he or she address our issues.
Gladys Quenda sells sweets, phone recharge cards, and other goods in the capital's central business district. Quenda says their wish is that things stabilize and that vendors stop being chased and that great structures are being built for them to operate from. She says they want it to be here in the central business district. That's where they want the government to designate areas vendors can sell from. Mavis Zuze is a young Zimbabwean. She wishes 2018 comes with prosperity. Zuze says she hopes there are jobs and a change from where they have been so they can move up to another level because they have suffered for a long time. She says they yearn to get better jobs. Some of them are educated but have nothing to do. We can't help the situation, she says. The overwhelming optimism that descended on the entire nation just over a month ago when Robert Mugabe left office still remains. Now Zimbabweans must wait to see if the new government can come through on its goals in the new year. For VOA, this is Kuzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans live outside the country. Many have not been able to visit their homeland for years or even decades. We spoke to some overseas Zimbabweans about their hopes for the holidays.
Dumiso Gobodi is a young Zimbabwean who lives in Virginia and works as an aircraft technician at Dulles Airport. He is doubtful that the new government will bring much change and says he won't return to Zimbabwe until it's clear there are jobs. His big wish for 2018.
I think the first expectation would be just the free and fair elections. Like, I mean, totally free and fair. Like, for once, where we have, like, no doubt, like, you know, let the people be heard. And just at that point, it doesn't matter who wins, you know, whether you like the person or not. As long as you feel like your voice has been heard and it's not marred by, like, allegations of fraud and all this or violence or none of that, I think that would be a great first step for me. Like, as long as we can get that, then anything is possible at that point.
Mududuzi Godwill Ndlovu is the ZAPU Europe Youth Leader in the United Kingdom, and he has four wishes for the new year.
Number one, free and fair elections, but it shouldn't start like near the election times. It should start now. I believe everybody, even if you're not a you're not in a political pot, but you want to campaign, you should have access to media and to the radio stations. Point number two, I would say devolution of power. Like every province, I think they should govern themselves, because in every province, people have different expectations. So one province might favor some policies and the other might not favor those policies. They might favor their own policies, I believe. Number three is the voice. As I've said earlier, that everybody should be given a chance to speak and not be arrested because he's against powerful members of state. So 3 points. And number four, whoever is in, he goes into power, whether it's an NDF, I expect them to rule Zimbabwe for Zimbabweans, not to continue being ruling them for ZANU-PF or for MDC or for whichever party. If you've won the elections through the political party that you've used, you now serve all Zimbabweans. So that's number four.
That was Mududuzi Godwill Ndlovu and Dumiso Gobodi, two young Zimbabweans in the diaspora.
You're listening to Zimbabwe Today from The Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. We continue with the news. President Emmerson Mnangagwa has given ministers in key industries 100 days to identify three target programs to improve the economy and the functioning of the government. From Harare, we spoke with Blessing Zulu with the VOA Zimbabwe service about those targets.
Yes, some ministers, like the Minister of Health, for example, has started announcing the goals and also what they have achieved at the moment. So it's still a work in progress. Some have been coming up with actually what they actually need to achieve in those first 100 days, things that the president says easy deliverables.
You mentioned that some ministries have actually started acting and announcing that they've achieved some of the goals. How many goals are they really acting on at this point?
It's not a specific number that they are giving, but each minister, each cabinet minister was tasked with actually coming up with goals for his particular ministry. For example, if you look at the Ministry of Home Affairs, people have been complaining for years that members of the Zimbabwe Republic Police were extorting money. There was a lot of corruption on the roads, and people were saying, and even the court begged that idea that members of the police were not supposed to be collecting money. So despite that particular court ruling, the police were defying it. But now members of the police have been banned by their minister and also by the president from collecting spot fines. They've also been ordered to reduce the number of roadblocks on the highways. I traveled to Bulawayo today. I noticed that the number of roadblocks have significantly declined from where they were about 30. I only saw about four, and they were not even harassing motorists. They were not even, you know, demanding port fines and other things that they'd been demanding.
Well, what do ordinary Zimbabweans see as important goals for the ministries?
For most Zimbabweans, I think what is key is to ensure that there is stability when it comes to the market, because prices have been going up, the price of fuel has also gone up. So things generally have gone from bad to worse in terms of the economy. So many people are hoping that whatever the president is doing, that should be to stabilize the market. And also many Zimbabweans are unemployed. Many are surviving on the informal sector. So people want the president to create jobs as of yesterday.
If the ministries don't actually come up with good targets and start meeting them, will they be penalized?
It appears that is what the president is demanding. Remember, he's also facing an election in 7 months, and I think this 100 days is something that they borrowed from Washington, which is rather ambitious when you look at Zimbabwe and where the country is actually coming from. And it would be very difficult, you know, to achieve those goals. This country has been under the leadership of former President Robert Mugabe for 37 years. It's ruined, you know, basically everything has collapsed. You look at the infrastructure, you look at electricity. Zimbabwe is a huge debt. You know, it owes a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars, to Eskom of South Africa, where it is actually buying electricity, and also Hahora Basa in Mozambique. All that needs a lot of money. So it's going to be difficult with an election coming. So it will be, I think the president will apply more pressure on his ministers. And by the way, even throughout the holidays, Mr. Mnangagwa is working. You pass through the government offices, Bunumutapa building is there. I just passed there a few minutes ago. He's still in office. He himself is actually leading by example, working off even on holidays, very long hours.
That was VOA's Blessing Zulu in Harare, speaking with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson.
. 2017 was a challenging year in many parts of the world. Egypt and its North American neighbors face significant terror threats, economic pressure, and political uncertainty. Edward Uranian in Cairo reviews the year that just ended and takes a look at what may lie ahead.
Egypt weathered a series of major terror attacks against civilian and military targets in 2017, causing significant loss of life and economic damage. As the Islamic State group crumbles, analysts predict more violence to come. Analyst David Otto of Global Risk International warns that returning jihadis will pose a threat to Egypt and the rest of North Africa.
Because the so-called Islamic Caliphate is collapsing in Syria and Iraq, we will then see a massive return of some of these jihadists who would be able to penetrate within the communities of North Africa, you know, areas like Egypt that has a very strong hold of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Egypt and Tunisia face a spillover of terrorists coming from neighboring Libya, a cauldron of political chaos and terrorism. Both Tunisian and Egyptian security forces have battled Islamic militants, infiltrating often unmarked borders. Rival governments in Libya have complicated the already thorny security situation across vast swaths of the country. The porous border is a problem, but Otto thinks a political solution is key.
Libya, which is very strategic within that region, that acts some kind of like a bridge between that region of North Africa and Central Africa, part of areas like Mali, Chad, Niger, and then towards the Mediterranean in Europe. If we still have this kind of instability within Libya, then it would be difficult for most of these North African countries to be able to deal effectively with the situation.
With 95 million people, Egypt is the Arab world's most populous country, and its security and economic situation has repercussions across both the Middle East and North Africa. A troubled economy represents a huge risk. The country's struggling tourism sector, its old and crumbling industrial base, and the challenge of integrating a mostly young and inexperienced workforce pose serious structural challenges to the government. Democracy activist and commentator Hisham Qasim says that a key problem for the government is how to attract foreign capital.
We have delayed some debts, but not defaulted. But lenders are beginning to look at something. The GDP is not rising, no sources of revenue have been created, and tourism has not picked up.
A big hurdle for Egypt in 2018 are presidential elections. Qasim says they will happen amid a bitter divide between Islamists and liberals who are not necessarily on the side of incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
On the political front, clearly there is no reconciliation happening in the country. The division is becoming very clear. Sisi supporters versus non-Sisi supporters.
Algeria, the Arab world's second largest country, also faces political and security challenges in 2018, as many expect incumbent President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to run for a fifth term. Like Egypt, Algeria has a large population of young people who feel they have no say in their future. Providing jobs for them, says analyst David Otto, is the most serious challenge for the region's leaders going into 2018.
You have North Africa, which has a growing population of young people who are disenfranchised, young people who are unemployed. So we have to be looking at towards building capacity, towards looking at prevent programs within communities.
If North African countries or their Saharan and sub-Saharan neighbors do not find solutions to the increasing droves of unemployed young people, the ongoing tragedy of refugees trying to flee by sea to Europe is likely to get worse, threatening the stability of Europe and the likelihood of more lives lost at sea. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Thousands of Africans in 2017 attempted to reach Europe, seeking safety and opportunity, adding to the European Union's migrant crisis. The number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Europe continued to fall in November, and the European Union says its policies to ease the crisis are working. But Amnesty International argues the bloc's collaboration with Libyan groups involved in the detention of migrants makes it complicit in gross human rights abuses. Henry Ridgewell looks back on Europe's migrant crisis in 2017.
In 2017, Europe claimed success in slowing the arrival of migrants. On the so-called Central Mediterranean route from North Africa, arrivals were down by a third. But Amnesty International's Maria Serrano says this has come at a terrible human cost.
Europe has decided to cooperate with Libyan authorities, knowing the kind of torture, abuses, detention that migrants and refugees are exposed to in Libya.
In November, video emerged apparently showing migrants being sold at a slave market in Libya, prompting international outrage and calls for urgent action from the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk.
Let me repeat my call to impose UN sanctions on human smugglers and traffickers.
European countries are providing tens of millions of dollars and training to the Libyan Coast Guard and armed groups under the control of the Tripoli unity government. That makes Europe complicit in the abuse, says Amnesty's Serrano.
They are sent to detention centres, official detention centres, and then militias and other armed groups and Libyan officials control these centres. So this is a source of money for them. Migrants are extorted. They are forced to call their families, and their families are listening to the awful abuses they suffer. So they receive beatings, they are tortured, women are raped.
The European Union has funded emergency repatriation flights to take migrants stranded in Libya back to their home countries. But there appears to be little political willingness to soften Europe's stance. EU leaders have trumpeted the falling migrant numbers as a way of countering anti-migrant populist forces, says political analyst Leopold Traugott of Open Europe.
The repercussions of the recent influx in 2016 and 2015 are still felt in most European countries. So until the EU decides and implements a new reform of its migration policies that is able to deliver sustainable solutions, the migrant crisis will still be an issue for European countries.
In 2015, Germany took in more than 1 million migrants. The backlash boosted support for the far right and cost Chancellor Angela Merkel votes at the September election. But supporters say her ultimate victory is proof that Germany and Europe can successfully integrate the migrants. Nevertheless, the European Union appears determined to close down the routes across the Mediterranean. Despite the risk of torture, abuse and drowning, more than 160,000 migrants made the journey in 2017. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That's it for us this evening on VOA's Zimbabwe Today. I'm Ayan Bior.
And I'm Chilonjere. We'll be back again tomorrow with our regular live program at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Debele broadcast can be heard at 6 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Debele and VOA Shona, as well as VOA website www.studio7news.com.
Yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Isimusi yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Tichitenda oga mwari wedu nemitsime. Tichitenda oga mwari wedu nemitsime. Ngatichengeta kusvika muzuva ranhasi. Ngatichengeta kusvika muzuva ranhasi. Vakawanda vakoniwa, vakawanda vatadza kupindamo, vakawanda vakoniwa, vakawanda vatadza kupindamo, vakawanda vakoniwa, vakawanda vatadza kupindamo, mugoreja, mugoreja, tinokutendai mugoreja, mugoreja, ingana sita pindamo, mugoreja, mugoreja, tinokutendai mugoreja, mugoreja. Yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Isimusi yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Yashika, yashika, oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Isimusi yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Isimusi yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari. Isimusi yashika, 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 oh, yashika, ungati pemberere amane shamwari.